So, short on building good relationships. I don't know if you heard, there was a little 12-year-old girl who was killed crossing a street in Miami. Her name was Shoshi Stern. So there was a rabbi who used to, she lived in Boca, I think, and commuted to school in Miami, and there was one of the teachers gave her and a few other children a ride, and he wrote a little piece about her. I think it was on the H.com website, and he wrote what he calls Shoshi's Rules. Her name was Shoshi Stern, and he said this is what he learned from her. Her family had a thing with her father, Mike's Rules, whatever it was, so he did Shoshi's Rules, and he said he noticed that whenever he gave a ride to a guest, Shoshi was the one who would give up her seat because it was a more comfortable position. She was always worried that everybody should be comfortable. And he said he sees that as symbolic. Her first rule would be give up your seat, your literal seat and your figurative seat. You know, people worry. It's interesting. I find it fascinating. They worry where they're seated at a dinner or at a simcha. Give up your seat means care about the other person. That's really, for her was an expression of caring. And he took it a step further and said, sometimes take a back seat and let somebody else shine. So that giving other people credit and letting them shine, it feels good and it's a wonderful opportunity and it works for a good relationship. His second rule of Shoshi's Rules was make peace. Apparently there were two serious cliques, I don't know, in her grade or in the school, and she was friends with girls in both, and she brought them together single-handedly, which the school was not able to do. Nobody could do it, but she did it at age 12. And then her third rule was see the good in everyone. She managed to find something good because she saw everybody as being created B'Tzelem Elokim. We have a, so to speak, a piece of Hashem in us that he has shared with us, and that's how she saw it. And then I was reading, I could not figure out how Judy Minkov did this to even speak at her daughter's unveiling, but I was reading what you gave me, and I just wanted to share that with people here also. She had planned to deliver some remarks at a social workers conference, and I just want to share this with you because I think it's also the secret of healthy and meaningful relationships. When I was diagnosed with stage 4 Hodgkin's disease in October 2008, my world was turned upside down. But I decided right then and there that the cancer would not define me. That's a huge sentence. I refused to have people look at me as another sick person to feel sorry for, even after many setbacks and life-threatening challenges. Through my personal experiences and positive outlook on life, she could have written that whole course, right? I want to dedicate my career to helping other cancer patients and their families. Having been through this experience, I realized that this is my calling. Every day is so valuable, and I want to do something meaningful with my life. That's what it's about. Every day is valuable, and I want to do something meaningful with my life. And meaningful could be giving somebody a smile who doesn't usually get a smile. Meaningful doesn't have to mean I will figure out a way to get astronauts on Mars. But whatever is meaningful for us, and there's the day-to-day meaningful, and there's the long-term meaningful. Which brings me, okay, this is a bottle of Smart Water. I'm going to read you the nutrition facts. Calories, zero. Total fat, zero. Sodium, zero. Total carbohydrates, zero. Protein, zero. Sounds worthless, right? You can't measure a darn thing in here. Excuse me. You can't measure anything in here. And we can't live without it. We can't live without water. We cannot measure a smile. We can't measure respect. We can't measure a chesed, a kindness that we do for somebody else. We can't measure sensitivity. We can't measure caring. Relationships can't survive without them. That's my point about water. It's all zeros, and we can't live without it. That's what I wanted to say. Then tonight, I'd like to take a look with you. I can't believe it. I didn't take one for myself. Okay. I'd like to look with you at roadblocks to good relationships and maybe some of the difficult people that we all end up either living with or working with or meeting. So if you look at the back of the first page, Rabbi Feldman's article, A Tale of Two Drivers. I'm going to sum it up for the people who might be watching. But basically, Rabbi Feldman was driving, and an Israeli driver, he was driving in Jerusalem, an Israeli driver just darted out full throttle, barely missed him, and he says if he hadn't slammed on his brakes, that person would have struck his car. Rabbi Feldman was furious. Natural reaction. So he followed that driver, beeping the whole way, honking his horn, and he was muttering to himself, always in a hurry, filled with chutzpah. No one knows how to drive, even though Israel apparently has tons of driving schools. And then he noticed that on that car was a blue ribbon, which was supporting the Gaza withdrawal. And on Rabbi Feldman's car, there was an orange ribbon in opposition to the Gaza withdrawal. Well, that just made it more serious. So, a moment later, I'll read the end. He stopped at the light. I pulled beside him, rolled down my window, and motioned to him. He rolled down his window, ready for a confrontation, and his wife was sitting beside him, cringing, expecting the worst. I don't know what came over me at that moment, but somehow the words that emanated from my throat were not the words I thought I would say. I said to him, "You have a blue ribbon, and I have an orange one, but we're both Jews, right?" Poor Israeli guy. So what's going on here? He says, "Most definitely. And we both love Israel, right?" "For sure." Totally bewildered. "Wonderful," I said, a smile on my face. "May God bless you with all good things. May you have good fortune in all that you do and good health and long life." His jaw dropped and he looked at me as if I were a lunatic. "Thank you. Thank you," he finally blurted out. And then after a long pause, he added, "By the way, I apologize for what I did back there. It was stupid. I am truly sorry." Which will enter the Guinness Book of Records as the very first time in the history of mankind that a reckless Israeli driver apologized for anything. The light turned green. He made a left turn. I made a right turn. And we went our separate ways. This is really also the secret. That driver was expecting anger and a tongue lashing, and instead, he practically got a blessing from Rabbi Feldman. And who knows what impact that had. But we know it had an impact on Rabbi Feldman because he felt good about it. And he didn't give in to his anger. So the major point I want to make about roadblocks to good relationships is we have a choice. People do all kinds of things. There will always be difficult people to live with and work with and that we meet. There will always be difficult people. We'll never escape them entirely. But we have choice in how we respond. And we have choice in remaining, I'll say menschlich, in keeping our composure even when we don't feel very composed. So I want to talk just about a few of the major roadblocks to good relationships. And one is competition. My father, Zechron Elevrocha, used to say that with competition, someone always wins, and that means that someone always loses. And very often in relationships, there's a competition to see whose needs get met. It happens in friendships, it happens in marriages. And instead of competing, which is a roadblock, what about working on win-win so that we work on the needs of both? So let's take a fairly typical example. Husband and wife both come home from work. The wife just wants to get out. She wants to get out. Husband just wants to stay in. He is bombed. He just wants to sit on that couch and watch a really good movie. What do? Hey, don't look to me for answers. What are their possibilities? Does one have to win and one have to lose? Is there a win-win? What? What would a win-win look like?
Compromise.
Okay, so one possibility is the one goes out and the other stays home, which is not terrible.
Or the wife goes out with her friends and he stays home.
Right.
She has a good time with her friends.
Not terrible.
You don't say whether they eat or not. No, because I would say go out and get some food and bring it home so they can both eat it.
I would say that too, mm-hmm. Yeah. And then they can sit together on the couch and watch a really good movie or something. Yeah. So the point is that it's so easy to slip into, why should he get his way? Why should she get her way? In any relationship, friends, family, marriage, and any relationship, if you eliminate that concept of, I'm going to let that one win, get rid of that competition concept, and you're free. The next is criticism, is probably, probably should have been first, even. Ongoing criticism. All of these things we all do sometimes, we all get angry sometimes, we all criticize sometimes, but a constant barrage of criticism just eats away at a relationship. It's one of the most destructive...
Toxic.
It is toxic, yes. And we'll talk about the criticizer a little bit later. The critic, I guess, is a better word. But criticism is really a tough one. Poor communication. Couldn't help sharing this quote with you from George Bernard Shaw. The single biggest problem in communication is the illusion that it has taken place. The single biggest problem in communication is the illusion that it has taken place. I think today we have an extra problem with our cell phones and our texts and tweets and emails, and they're all right there. And I see people at dinner. In fact, somebody told me she had a 20-year-old grandchild over her house for supper with a friend. I asked her how it went. She said, "Well, they sat next to each other texting the whole time." So that's not called communication. I'm not sure what it's called, and maybe for the younger generation that's what they call communication, but the truth is research is now showing that it's, I think you used the word isolating, there isn't a full expression as we get when we actually talk to each other.
Were you saying they were texting to each other?
Yes.
Instead of talking?
Correct.
Oh, they were texting. Wow.
They were texting to each other instead of talking.
Nah,
they probably have free unlimited.
They can also criticize without saying a word.
Yeah.
Which I know that my daughter and her peers will have the habit of doing.
But they're texting to the person they're criticizing.
Right, because you wouldn't say anything, but you could say.
Oh, you mean they might have been criticizing
the critique or criticize.
I see. Okay. Not criticizing each other, but I don't like this food or something like that.
I don't
want to
be here.
Well, you know what? If somebody has invited you for a dinner, put the phone down. Put it away.
That would be like Texas, check your guns instead of check your guns.
Right, check yourselves.
But Dr. Westberg, don't you think there's a happy medium? Sometimes I think when my kids write emails to me, they express themselves differently, and I like that. I like the, or even a text sometimes, you know.
But do they talk to you too?
Oh, yeah, but I mean, okay. Of course, they would say something like, "Mom, it's time for you to start learning how to text more." I don't always answer my phone. I don't have any minutes left.
Come, you don't have unlimited.
Well, no, I'm just joking. I mean, I'm saying whatever it is, or my battery's low. But I think that sometimes it's good to see a different dimension with.
So email gives another way to express yourself. But if it becomes the only way, the texting and tweeting and emailing, then that's when we have a problem. But you text a lot? It saves time. I'm not.
I wouldn't say that I text, like, do something that, like, discussion that needs to happen, like, in a relationship, not even a serious thing. But I think that obviously it's an effective way of planning something.
Or, you know, for a quickie. Yes, for something quick, like, do you have, can I borrow some sugar? That's great. Okay, that makes sense, because if you call me, what if I don't answer? And then, so, fine. Or can we talk, are you available at 6 o'clock? But for full conversations, I think phones are just, I've had people like, this was even before all the cell phones, where somebody called me and she was crying and and then she said, oh, can you hold on, I have a beep. And her whole voice changed. Please, you know, if it's your life, if it's that serious, ignore the beep. And we're having a harder and harder time ignoring the beep. I know for when my husband and I drive to New York together, or usually it's New York, we just made up that we'll, for an hour, hour and a half, we turn off our cell phones, and that's our time. Okay, we understand that, you know, he has to be in touch. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But that hour or hour and a half belongs to us. And it's almost symbolic to turn off the cell phone. It's like and making an announcement that that's our time. And I think it's a challenge. I don't want to condemn cell phones. Where would we be without them? They have a lot of pluses, you're right. At the same time, we don't want them to rule our lives. I read an article recently that parents are not interacting with their young children the same way. Mm-hmm. So even in the middle of reading a book, they're checking their email or they're texting. So the child doesn't get that full attention, and they're beginning to see the effects. The children are coming to school, even being brought up in a home with books and certain, you know, and good games, they're coming to school missing the skills that kids who grew up with parents reading to them before bedtime and playing with them, they don't have quite the same level of skills. Will they make up for it? Maybe, but why should they have to? And it's coming out now in research, so it says to me, we have to see who's in charge here. Is the phone in charge, or are we in charge? And I don't know why a little phone should exert such power over our lives. We can choose not to answer. I think you said sometimes you don't answer the phone. Mm-hmm. Okay, great. Take a look at that first page, myths that are roadblocks to good relationships. One of my favorites is the mind reader myth. And I'm sure we all do this sometimes. The main thing is not to do it all the time. If my friend really cared about me, she would know what I want for my birthday. I don't have to tell her. Yes, I do. Nobody can read our minds. And that's because each one of us is unique. And even though we know somebody for years and years and years, and even though we love somebody for years and years and years, we cannot read their minds. I think that's how two people can stay together for 100 years, because they're always growing, they're always changing, and we don't read each other's minds. There's no such thing. Don't count on anybody figuring out what your needs are or what your wants are. We have to learn to say them. Women are particularly good at hinting or counting on the mind reading. I don't know if that's part of our upbringing, but research does indicate that we are better at that. Maybe we feel like, how can we ask for something? We're, you know, we tend to be the givers. I don't know exactly why. It's something we all have to be aware of. How about the happiness myth? How many times do I hear, well, he doesn't really make me happy. Or this friend doesn't make me happy. No one has to make me happy. I have to make me happy. My circumstances will make me happy. My friends will make me happy. My spouse can bring joy to my life. But I'm sure we've all seen people who seem like they should be happy, and they're not, because they're not choosing happiness. And then we meet people who should be unhappy, we think, and they're happy. They're happy because they're happy to be alive. They're happy to have another day. They're happy to have opportunities. They're happy to have their health. They're happy to have their friends, whatever it is, their family, but they find happiness wherever they go. There's a myth out there, now it's a little bit better, that men and women speak the same language. Since John Gray wrote Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus, people have become a little more convinced. It's funny because in Judaism is always a little out of step, you know, with the trends. We always said that men and women are different. And when the whole feminism thing started, they started by going to the extreme, which sometimes you have to do to make a shift, and said that there are no differences, men and women are the same. In fact, I know about a psychology professor who insisted to his classes for years that men and women are exactly the same, boys and girls are exactly the same, there's nothing built in that's different about them, it's all the upbringing and the expectations. And then he gave his 3-year-old daughter a truck for her birthday, and he felt really good about doing that. He was proving his point. She was going to have a truck, no sexist doll or anything for her. And he was feeling quite good about it until he passed her room, and he sees that she had wrapped the truck up in a blanket and was rocking the truck. And he then went back to his class and said, "I'm wrong."
But that's not right either. As an early childhood educator, I'll tell you that if this girl...
Could you speak up so people can hear?
If this girl had an older brother or an older sister, she would not do that with a truck. It's what she... I know children who are the other sex from their older sibling, and they do what the older sibling does.
Yes, that is true. But what he saw was that there was some instinct built in. Maybe she didn't have an older sibling. I don't know.
But again, I mean, if you copy someone, doesn't mean that it's your instinct.
That's true.
On the contrary, you're just trying to imitate, so you're trying to...
Right. But the differences will come out at some point. And the differences are fascinating, but we don't speak the same language. So we think we're saying red, but that other person, and I don't think it's just men and women, I think it's any two people. It's particularly stark between men and women, but the truth is any two people, and that's why in a healthy relationship and in a normal conversation, we check. I'm sorry, did you mean ABC? No, why would you think I meant ABC? Well, that's how it sounded like, because I bring my personality, my experiences to everything I hear. So I'm always hearing and seeing through a lens, so to speak, the whole lens of my entire life. But by checking, we can find out. It's very important to check. And the myth of the right way. We tend to think that a real friendship, this is what I hear people say, a real friendship should look like this. Why? Who said that? And what kind of friendship? We could have 5 different types of friendship. There's the friend you go shopping with. There's the friend you would never go shopping with, but you would love to go to a concert with. There's the friend that you wouldn't discuss food with, and there's the friend that you'd love to go out to eat with. That's why we have many friends, or a variety of friends, because first of all, we can't get everything from one person. Go back to the happiness myth. And second of all, there is no right way. We have different kinds of relationships, and that enriches our lives. That's healthy. So we don't want to fall into that only one right way. And the perfect relationship. There's only one type of friendship or marriage, and if it's not that way, we're failures. Anybody ever hear that one? Mm-hmm. I hear it a lot, and I find it very sad, because the truth is, even there are some marriages that thrive on fighting. That's how they communicate, and that's how they relate. And if it works for them, I'm not going to tell them to stop, and I'm not going to say it's all wrong. It works. I've seen some like that. It's not my ideal, and it may not be your ideal, but it works for that particular couple. Because don't they hate? Or friends who are, a lot of their friendship is competition or kind of, how do you say, shtuch?
Sarcasm,
thank you, that's good. Sarcasm, that's how they relate. Fine, they're happy. If the friendship is working, that's fine. Do you see the soul of money underneath the myths? I'll tell you why I put that in. Well, you'll tell me why I put that in. For those who don't have the papers, I'm just going to read it through. No, on the computer.
Oh.
This is from The Soul of Money by Lynn Twist. For me and for many of us, our first waking thought of the day is, I didn't get enough sleep. The next one is, I don't have enough time. Whether true or not, that thought of not enough occurs to us automatically before we even think to question or examine it. We spend most of the hours and the days of our lives hearing, explaining, complaining, or worrying about what we don't have enough of. Before we even sit up in bed, we're already inadequate, already behind, already losing, already lacking something. And by the time we go to bed at night, sorry for the misprints, our minds are racing with a litany of what we didn't get or didn't get done that day. We go to sleep burdened by those thoughts and wake up to that reverie of lack. This internal condition of scarcity, this mindset of scarcity, lives at the very heart of our jealousies, our greed, our prejudice, and our arguments with life. There was something about that that moved me, and I wanted to ask you what you thought of it. Okay. To me, it's ironic, because we're living in an age that is super abundant, in a country that is super, super abundant, and we're focused on this scarcity and what we're missing. And Brené Brown talks about this a lot, and she often asks people to fill in, I'm not blank enough. And it could be, I'm not smart enough, I'm not successful enough, I'm not skinny enough, I'm not pretty enough, I'm not visual enough, I'm not organized enough. People have no trouble filling that in. And I think what Lynn Twist is telling us here in The Soul of Money is that mindset is not healthy. It's not healthy for us as individuals. I mean, how many people here wake up in the morning tired and saying, I could use a lot more sleep, or I didn't get enough sleep? We all do, right? I mean, most of us, with young children around or without, it doesn't matter. We're all feeling sleep deprived, and studies show that most of us really are sleep deprived. One antidote is, I know that when you wake up in the morning and you say, Moda Ani, thank you, Hashem, for letting me wake up and for giving me another day and another opportunity, it fights that scarcity thinking a little bit. Could I hear some people's opinions on that?
Sure.
On this piece. What did you think?
I almost think it's like people saying that they feel they have no purpose in life. They really don't know what they're here for. You know, that's what I'm reading.
You hear this as saying, I don't have a purpose in life?
Because a person who would really feel like they have a purpose wouldn't feel that way. You know,
Everything that they're missing. If a person has a purpose in life,
right. I think that's
they don't have that scarcity track playing in their heads.
But stress can make it really hard for some days.
I'm repeating for the people because people told me they couldn't hear. Stress can make it difficult.
Right.
Ladies, friends of Rachel, come on.
I think it's also focusing on the negatives, and we always feel the need to, instead of looking for the good in things,
then maybe you can get support that way.
Maybe we can get support that way, by complaining about what's missing or what's bad, we get sympathy, do we?
I think that there's that idea of complaining to someone and getting them to complain back, and that kind of.
So you share, you feel bad for each other.
Misery loves company.
Misery loves company.
Maybe instead of getting the negative back, maybe getting the reinforcement of the positive, of, you know, but look where you are, look what's going on in your life, you know, the, look how you're spending this time with somebody, or look how you've got this job, other people don't.
So you're saying when someone complains, maybe there's some positive coming back.
That's what they're looking for too, it depends on what their needs are.
Sure, go ahead, please. That sounds a little idealistic to me. I wish it were the case. Yes?
I mean, I feel that it's someone that is trying to give him or herself excuses for not achieving what she wants to achieve. Means, you know, like, if you come and I didn't do, it's like, you're disappointed in yourself in some fashion, and then you give yourself excuses. You find excuses, well, it's because I don't have enough this.
You find excuses not to achieve what you want to, or to,
right.
Whether it's in relationships
or
work.
Not achieving what you
so even
like to do. So, you know.
So this. This gives a good reason. I didn't get enough sleep. I didn't get enough done.
Right.
Okay.
I think it, I guess more of it, similar to what you're saying, but more of not as an excuse, but like a fear. Like, therefore, like, I do intend of, you know, getting done my entire to-do list tomorrow, but, like, and I do really want to do this, and I want to connect with these people, on the off chance that I don't make my goal, even though I'm going to make every effort to, I need to set aside that fear that it's not necessarily.
So it's almost a fear of failure. And I'm setting up my safety net already, which I think brings us back to that shame. I'm not enough. It's not that I didn't get enough sleep and I didn't get enough time. And I didn't have enough opportunity. I'm not enough. I won't get my list done today. I'm going to start protecting myself now by saying, I'm sleep deprived. I can't get enough done. I'm too busy. I think you hit on a very basic point, where we spend a lot of our lives protecting ourselves from a sense of failure and a sense of not being worthwhile. So, yes. Yeah. Thank you. I just
it's
put in some
like
of
the news.
I'm sorry?
You know, the news are all bad because people want to hear bad things. Why news that give you good
news does
good
not
news
sell.
Do not sell.
How many articles so, about the dog that doesn't bite the person will you read?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. So, what need in the human condition does it fulfill to have to hear bad news?
To hear negative, so much negative.
Right. It has to feel some need or some lack, like feeling not enough.
So it seems that we feed off of negativity some way, you're saying. We almost need to hear all the negative stuff.
Why?
But then if you look at the Boston Marathon, you can turn that around and see the overwhelming,
incredible,
you know, outpouring of kindness
people
showed that it restores your faith a little bit. And,
definitely. Know. People ran to the scene of the bombing knowing that there could be another one, which happens very often. But the negative...
That is going to sell... I mean, this is
only if it's part of the crisis
of the,
or trauma.
Exactly. But if it's just on its own, I mean, you're not going to have a big first page saying, look at this wonderful person that went and helped, you know.
Right.
That's not what is gonna make it sad.
That won't make, looking at a wonderful person rarely makes front page news. Right, but it's not the norm. It's not the norm. I don't know why. I guess, I don't know. But in our own lives, we could make the positive the norm.
I remember somebody looking at, was it you that said something about a newspaper back in like 1800s or another lecture I was part of, and that if you look at the New York Times back then and what the articles, front page articles were, it was about something that happened in Ohio as far as who won the cake contest, who won this, and we've become to the point where the news is the bad news. And now bad news is like so permeant in our lives that you open up a paper, that's what you expect. So it's almost refreshing to have the front page news thinking to have those positives there, because those are the rarities now. And that maybe will bring a shift to our culture, to people, because people, negative will always attract negative, and it will bring us down further. Whereas when you are negative and you go to something, to the light, or to go to something positive, even going to a class, you know, it brings you closer to God. It brings you closer to a more positive realm, okay? And that will bring you more happiness. It will bring you to a positive feeling, even if it's just for that hour, and you have to go back to a negative situation, but it'll still make you feel good for that short period of time.
So watch for Miriam.
Yeah.
Watch for Miriam's newspaper. It's going to be all good news. And very little negative news.
Do you think maybe we, some of us get sadistic pleasure, or what's it called, Schadenfreude, where you realize you can complain, and then you read a story or see something like that, and not that you want to wish something terrible on someone, but you say, wow, you know, I would never do anything like that, and I'm better than that. And so I think maybe
so it makes us feel better about ourselves,
mm-hmm.
sometimes to read some of the negative
somebody
news.
Else's misery and say, well, things could be a lot worse, or you know,
yeah.
or that would never
yeah.
happen in my family, but of course
we
no
think
such thing is never
we
right,
think
you know.
right and maybe we're, you know, maybe we defend ourselves that way and protect ourselves.
Yeah,
sure.
I'm wondering.
Yeah. I just want to make sure you catch some of the cartoons. On that first page, Why We'll Never Understand Each Other. I love those. For those listening in, this is a husband and wife. What he heard is his wife saying, "You're way too stupid to be trusted driving alone in bad weather." What she actually said, "Drive carefully, dear." And typical, right?
Yeah.
So again, that's, we, even with difficult people, we need to do a little check on how we're hearing what's happening and what they're saying to us and how they're behaving towards us. Sometimes it's not really as bad as we're ready to believe. Do you like the pepper and salt?
Mm-hmm.
"No, dear, I don't know what happened to the art of conversation, and I don't want to discuss it." That's also a little bit, that tells us a little bit about what we call in relationships the pursuer and the pursued. Very often in relationships, there's someone who's chasing after the other person to spend time, to pay attention, to give compliments, and it's just human nature, but the more a person feels that someone is chasing after her, the more she runs away.
Mm-hmm.
And this happens a lot with couples. I think it happens a lot in friendships too. There's very often a pursuer and a pursued. And the best approach for that is for the pursuer to stop pursuing so much, and the pursued comes back a little bit and does a little pursuing herself. The other point with the teenagers. Oh, I'm sorry, you got two the same. The other point is that we go through stages in life, and people that we relate to go through different stages. They go through hard times, easier times, just growing themselves and developing. And we need to take that into consideration also. I thought Anne Frank really put it perfectly. That's how teenagers feel. If I talk, everyone thinks I'm showing off. When I'm silent, they think I'm ridiculous. Rude if I answer, sly if I get a good idea. Lazy if I'm tired, selfish if I eat a mouthful more than I should. Stupid, cowardly, crafty. Teenagers do have a sense that they can't win. You know, everyone's against them. The one where the fellow, Mom, did you do my laundry? Yes, Brad. Did you iron my flannel? It's hanging in your closet. Dad, my car's not running. Can I use yours? And I need to borrow $20. Oh, and I'm taking your CD player, okay? I can't find mine. Anyone know what time it is? My watch is busted. And then Mom says, it's 6 o'clock. Be home by 10:30. And he says, Mom, I'm 19. Don't you think I can handle a little independence? Mm-hmm. So, yeah. And
this is really dated because now people look at their cell phones for time.
Right. They don't wear watches anymore. It's true. Very true. So my point, besides that, I wanted to give you a good laugh. My point was that people go through different stages, and what's really normal for a teenager, mm-hmm. and I think, by the way, if she was doing that cartoon now, she'd say 16, not 19, but okay. What's normal for a teenager, we have to learn to accept that that's normal for a teenager. Doesn't mean we don't sometimes respond, but we don't have to worry. If that was a 30-year-old, we might be more concerned. So, again, we go through different times. You like the Calvin and Hobbes? Those are really just for fun. But I think this one, oh, I'll wait till you're there. This one really sums up roadblocks to good relationships. Yeah. And I see what happened. It is cute, but it also shows distorted thinking. The father really, I'm guessing, you know, it's a cartoon, but he really thinks that telling his child, you're a hopeless clod, is being honest. Right? We give him responsibility. You're to blame. And I can't understand why he has no confidence. What would you recommend for a child in that situation?
Well, I mean, I don't know that, but I'm just saying there is such a thing where there are people who do believe, I mean, it's a faulty conception, but like that really when you love somebody, you just criticize them. And in their mind, that's how they really love, is through criticism.
So there are people, you want to say there are people who criticize out of love. If I keep telling you what you're doing wrong, you'll shape up.
It's a distorted way of thinking, but in their mind, that's how they
express their caring.
You know, they're caring. It's unfortunate.
Yes, very unfortunate.
I also think that different people deal with situations differently, whereas some people, like if it's a difficult situation, they might make like really sarcastic jokes about it, and that's how they deal.
If they're on the receiving end of the difficult situation?
Well, just in a situation, like if there's like a challenging thing that like a family's going through, like they find the best way to deal with it is to make a joke about it. And like with me, like I'm a little bit more sensitive, so I don't like when people turn it into a joke, and then I get like upset because to me it's
don't turn my issue into a joke.
Yeah,
or
people,
use sarcasm.
People are going through it with me, like they, to them, the way that they deal with it is to like, you know, make it a laugh.
And do you know why?
Because they're having a hard time
dealing with it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. So for me, like I have to understand that that's the way that they're doing
right.
it.
Right. To save yourself. Yeah. Not even for their sake,
even
but for your own.
Making it more challenging for me to go through it because then they're making a joke about
when they're sarcastic or they're making a joke about something you're going through, it makes it much harder to deal with it. But they don't want to deal with it.
Yeah.
So, and once you know that, you can take it with a little bit less intensity.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you can even say something, like, I need support here, please. You know, no sarcasm allowed, whatever, or even more serious. This doesn't work for me. I'm glad it works for you. It doesn't work for me. You can share that, but if it's somebody who always responds that way and can't deal with heavy duty emotions, you just might have to tell yourself. And that's the real secret of living with bad relationships or bad, difficult people. The poor kid in this one, you know, where, as you said, there might be people who think they're doing that out of love. What could you come up with, some way, what could he do about this? He has no confidence, right? That any confidence he might have had has been really beaten out of him.
Mm-hmm.
What can such a person do? And, you know, we talked about we can choose happiness and we can choose to change. This is hard. This is not just opening up a book and learning how to be happy when you have a drumbeat of criticism and negativity. Come on, let's cure the world.
I want to tell you, when one of my children, I'm not going to say no,
good,
was very little, he was very klutzy. And I was always saying to him, come on, you're always bringing up the rear, and I was always criticizing him. Then I realized that he is responding to me. So I learned to keep my mouth shut. I had a very sore tongue, but after a while,
so sometimes when we see a klutzy child or a child without confidence, we have to look at ourselves.
Right.
Or in any relationship, you know, we need to take a look at ourselves. How about our poor fellow here? What could he do?
I'm just thinking from the Jewish perspective, we're all created in the image of God, you know, God loves us all, and, you know.
The only problem I have with that is that children think of God the way they've experienced their parents. That's why honoring our parents is right up there, you know,
mm-hmm.
among the Ten Commandments. And it's on the side that has to do with relationship between us and God, not on the side that has to do with relationships between us and other people. His parents are the connection. So like one of my sisters told me, she was convinced that God looked just like our father when she was a kid, because he was so wonderful and loving and terrific.
Mm-hmm.
So God must look like that. It's an immaturity, but and we move past it, but our sense of God's love for us and protection of us has a lot to do with our childhood and what we experienced from the adults in our lives. I do know someone who had an upbringing similar to this cartoon, believe it or not. And when he hit, I think like about 18, 19, he discovered self-help books, and he listened to interviews of people who had experienced what he experienced, and he sort of brought himself up that way and learned to appreciate himself. He did a lot of reading and a lot of listening, and he sort of turned off the tapes of his childhood and substituted them with his own tapes. So we really are able to do that. It takes a lot of work and determination, but we can do that. We can undo or redo, I'm not sure what you would call it, but we can do that. So even if we've had some really difficult people in our lives and we've gotten some very negative messages, we can replace those messages.
Or choose friends who can validate you or who stay positive about everything.
Or choose friends who can validate you. Unfortunately, what often happens is if that's not done consciously, unconsciously, people drift to friendships and relationships that will repeat
mm-hmm.
what they're used to, because that's
mm-hmm.
their comfort level. It's the same, I find it the most ironic thing, but most people who are abusive were abused as children, and you would think that's the absolutely last thing they would ever do, having experienced it, but that's all they know. Mm-hmm. When you're angry, hit, mm-hmm. lash out. Mm-hmm. That's what they know. They're not equipped unless they determine mm-hmm. to learn skills and techniques and become equipped. So it's a decision. That's my point. It's a decision to make friends that are going to be positive and will validate.
But so often you hear of like teenagers who just are so criticized that they run up and they involve themselves in high risk kinds of
right.
behaviors and you know just
and in relationships where
right.
they're criticized.
As a form of punishment to the person who
to the parents
to the
or
parents
the
or
adults in their lives.
Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely.
So it takes a rare person to be, watching tapes, listening to.
I think so. I had a lot of respect for that person,
yeah.
and it gave me hope too. You know, he could have just ended up on the floor, figuratively and literally. So let's talk about living with difficult people. And we said we'll always have difficult people. Number one is. Work really hard not to take their remarks personally. If you weren't standing there and someone else was standing there, that person would get it because it's not about us, it's about the person who's being difficult. It's their issues, it's their insecurities, 99.9% of the time. The trick for us is to recognize that it doesn't feel good. And figure out some way to respond that's not obnoxious, because we want to retain our dignity and our kindness and all the things that we value, which seem to go out the window when we really get criticized or hurt or we feel that somebody took credit for something that we've done. There are all kinds of difficult people. So we basically have to kick in with everything we talked about. We don't want to be a doormat. I don't think we have to take abusive talk or very angry, but we can be assertive. We don't have to answer anger with anger. We don't have to answer a nasty remark with another nasty remark. I was once shopping with my mother, and the sales lady was really, I think obnoxious is a good word, and I'm saying, Mom, let's get out of here. And instead, my mother turned to her and said, you must be having a very difficult day. Oh no, this is really bad. The lady absolutely melted. She said, I really am. Thank you for understanding. And was so helpful afterwards. I couldn't believe it. But I don't think most of us could do I think if I would do that, I couldn't do it. But my mother wasn't going to leave a nasty situation without trying to fix it in some way, which was her way. And she saw beyond the obnoxious behavior. That's really the challenge. That's the other side of the story, not judging others. What she saw was a woman in distress. What I saw was an obnoxious mm-hmm. human being who didn't have sense enough to treat a customer nicely. She focused on the distress. She won. She got it. So I learned a powerful lesson that day, too. Even if I don't necessarily find it in me to do that, I'd probably just leave. But sometimes we can't leave a difficult person or a difficult situation. That focus on who is this really? This is a person having a very tough day. This is a person filled with insecurities. Whatever it is, at least makes it easier for us and makes it possible for us to feel, okay, this is not about me. The real issue is that we need to feel valued and we need to feel worthwhile. And when someone attacks, it shakes up the equilibrium. All of a sudden, I'm not sure I'm worthwhile, and what if that person is right? And so we get shaken up. I think also just the not niceness of it shakes it up. So sometimes just being able to ask myself, okay, what are the facts here? Facts here is that this person said something really not nice to me. I don't think it had anything to do with me. And number two, second question to ask is, what am I telling myself about the facts? Because I might be telling myself, well, I guess I deserve that, or I guess she's right. I have no value, as opposed to, I don't have to buy it. She can sell it if she wants to. I don't have to buy it. So we have to talk our way through it, whether it's looking at who is this person saying it and somehow feeling some compassion or understanding and knowing that it's not about us. That really makes life much easier. We don't want to respond to anger with anger. People who are angry are not able to deal with any kind of logic, and anger just breeds more anger. Sometimes we just have to turn around and walk away. Also, if there's a breakdown in communication somehow, we can very nicely say, please let me finish my sentence, or I think you didn't understand what I said. We can respond. We don't have to be the doormat. We can stand up for ourselves, not aggressively, but assertively. You know the difference? Mm-hmm. Okay, what is it? I don't know how to put it. What is it? What's the difference between aggressive and assertive?
Assertive is just making your point, getting your point across. Being aggressive is throwing it on them and forcing it on them.
That works for me. Assertive is getting your point across while maintaining your sense of self and composure. And aggressive is more coming out fighting. Okay, I'll buy that. So let's look at critical people. Do we have a real fast? Critical people. So there are two basic things for all the difficult people that we live with. If we don't have to relate to them, avoid them. You know? We don't have to, and sometimes we don't figure it out. We have a friend who keeps turning on us, and there's value to the friendship, but we never feel quite good about it. We don't have to maintain that friendship. It's okay, and we don't have to feel bad about not maintaining it. So we can just also, we can disengage or ignore. So that critical person, sometimes we can just say, I see, or okay, or I'll think about that. We don't have to buy it, but I would say don't argue. The arguing just makes the critical person criticize more. It's not worth it. Another lesson that I learned mostly from my mother is people who are the hardest to love are the ones who need it the most. Mm. And if we think of that, you know, we've all seen it with our own children. When they're being the most obnoxious, that's when they need a hug. Mm-hmm. It's much easier to see it with our own and with people that we truly, truly love. But it really is a rule of thumb across the board. People who are the hardest to love are the ones who need it the most. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean we're the ones to give it to them. But if we keep that in mind, suddenly that critic or that person who's so difficult to live with looks very vulnerable. And that evokes a different response from us, I believe. Never ask a critic for his opinion. Really avoid it like the plague. I just want to touch on the naysayers. You know, whatever you do, I'm starting to eat healthy. Healthy's boring, and you'll never do it. You'll stop after 3 days. They kill our dreams. They destroy our vision if we let. So we have to keep a focus. No, I really do want to start eating in a healthy way. Not to say it to them, just say it to yourself and say it to someone who will be supportive. You don't need support from a naysayer, and you don't get into any long discussions because you're not changing that person's mind, and that person hopefully is not changing your mind. Just keep positive. Keep people around you who are going to say, yeah, you can do it, you can do it, I did it, and you go to the support group, they'll help you, or here's a website. Go somewhere, anywhere, where you will get the positive that you need. Some people are just negatives. Someone told me that a good friend called her up. She was about to embark on taking a new course, and the friend called her up and said, I just wanted to wish you well and everything. I hope you really get what you're looking for from this course. It probably wasn't worth all the money that you paid, though. And I heard the presenter is really not so good. And she called me right afterwards. She said, should I go? I said, of course. What? Just because this person is telling you all negative, you made a decision. Stick with it, of course. But it shook her up. So don't tell your dreams to the naysayer. Okay. There's the angry person, the procrastinator, but the rules are basically the same. Don't expect the procrastinator to come on time. I have a friend who was getting married, and her chuppah was in one place and the dinner was in another, and a very important family member had a reputation for always coming late. So I said, no problem, just tell him that the dinner is an hour earlier than it really is. He came right on time, an hour late for what he thought, and right on time. It wasn't the most comfortable thing because it was deceptive, but it was her wedding. She needed him there on time, so we did it. Sometimes you just have to do that. The trick with the procrastinator is their value is tied to how good they will do. So if there is a slight chance, even a very slight chance, that they won't be successful in accomplishing what they're supposed to do, they don't want to go there. It's like being annihilated. It's really a fear of failure, which is the perfectionist also. That's really what's going on with the procrastinator. I know we all procrastinate and we all criticize. I'm saying more when it's the standard behavior. I have a friend who's married to someone who's always late. Always late. She's been left on street corners because he forgot to pick her up. And finally, one time I couldn't help it. I said, how do you stand it? She said, well, there's so much good. There's so much other stuff that's really good. And that I realized that's just who he is. Mm-hmm. So that's also, you know, and she was right. There is so much good. I just couldn't, you know, at one point I finally said, you've been left on too many street corners. How do you deal with it? But you focus on the good. But the procrastinator, there's a reason behind that procrastination. And it's usually fear of not meeting the expectation, not living up to whatever that person is trying to live up to.
So how does that work with someone coming late to something? You know, I mean, always not being on time. How is that a fear?
What's that person afraid of, you mean?
Yeah. I mean, they're going to come.
They're going to come.
They're going to come.
They're going to, yes. Yeah, so that's a little bit, but they're also saying something with that behavior. If you know they're always late and they're saying something, I have to think about that.
Okay. It could be that they're saying that they're not sure what kind of interaction is going to happen, so their fear of the interaction, fear of not knowing
maybe
what's going to happen at the event. There's so many fears that could come up from there that they're like, oh,
I'll just come late.
For a while, and you play this whole dance in your head.
So it's too much stress to be there the whole time.
But they're also setting themselves up for failure.
And they're setting themselves up for people being angry at them. And I have to wonder if that's a little piece in there, too.
It also could be have to do with what they're doing prior to that. Because let's say they're more of a fear of not completing what they were doing before they're getting there.
But if you know you have to be somewhere, you build your day, you know that you're not going to start cleaning a closet 20 minutes before you have to be somewhere and all dressed up.
And sometimes you do the closet 20 minutes before because then
you don't want to
say that, all right, I have to do this, and now I can say, I have an excuse. I need to finish this before I can go out.
Okay.
Or just unrealistic about how long it's going to take you to get from point A to point B, not accounting for traffic at rush hour, you know, not thinking
so that works for me once in a while, but if someone
it's a chronic thing.
Yeah, if a person is 40 years old and still can't figure out how to get their own time, there's a reason. We don't have to know the reason, we just have to know there is a reason and see that there's a vulnerability. Could I give you a little assignment for next week? Next week I'd like to do some dilemmas in relationships. A dilemma means we have two yucky choices or two good choices. Whatever we do is going to be tough. Think about a dilemma that we can either break up into a couple groups or we could tackle a few dilemmas more to see how can we approach a dilemma in relationships. I don't have answers, but we could work together on how to figure it out, how to come to what we think is the best conclusion. And we may not agree, and that's okay too.